A ferocious wildfire tears through the heart of the Hawaiian island of Maui, reducing much of the historic town to ash.
The fact that it was spreading so fast and you didn't really know what was going to happen, and then of course like losing your stuff and not really knowing, you know, where you're going to go for the night.
Plus, the U.S. expresses growing concern for the well-being of Niger's ousted president and his family.
In all of the conversations Secretary Blinken has had with President Bazoum, inquiring about his safety has been the first things he's brought up.
And an Ecuadorian presidential candidate has been shot and killed at a campaign rally in the capital, Quito. Today is Thursday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. An Ecuadorian presidential candidate known for speaking up against corruption was shot and killed Wednesday at a political rally in the capital, Quito. President Guillermo Lasso confirmed the assassination of Fernando Villavicencio. Ecuador's attorney general's office said a suspect in the assassination died of wounds after being arrested by authorities. A wildfire ripped through the Hawaiian island of Maui on Wednesday with alarming speed and ferocity, destroying dozens of homes and businesses in a historic tourist town. Aerial video after sunrise revealed entire blocks of buildings reduced to ash and thick smoke in the air. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Mahina Martin, a spokesperson for Maui County, tells the AP that fire is widespread in Lahaina. One firefighter was injured. Schools are closed and some areas have been cut off by downed trees and power lines. The Coast Guard rescued 12 people who jumped into the ocean to escape the fire.
And people don't really know the severity.
Clint Hansen narrated his drone footage of the fire burning through the night.
Kihei in the distance, you see. Guys, please stay safe. Looks like Lahaina is absolutely devastated.
The acting governor has issued an emergency proclamation. The island of Oahu is also dealing with downed power lines and traffic problems. The National Weather Service says Hurricane Dora passing to the west is partly to blame for winds with gusts of up to 80 miles an hour that are fanning the flames. I'm Jennifer King.
The United States is providing up to $200 million in additional military aid to Ukraine. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
Two U.S. officials tell VOA the package is expected later this week and will include more rockets for HIMARS and more munitions for Patriot surface-to-air missile defense systems. The officials say the aid also includes mine-clearing equipment and anti-tank weapons such as TOW missiles and AT-4s fired over the shoulder. The latest aid package will mark the 44th authorized presidential drawdown of military equipment from Defense Department inventories since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ukraine in February 2022. Moscow began a renewed offensive in Ukraine earlier this year that has stalled, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has characterized his current counteroffensive against Russian forces as slow but steady, as Ukrainian forces have inserted reserve troops and broken through some elements of Russian forces' southeastern defensive lines in recent days. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Meanwhile, officials in Kyiv say a Russian rocket attack Wednesday killed two people and wounded at least seven others in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. And in Russia, an explosion on the grounds of a factory north of Moscow that makes optical equipment for its security forces killed one person. Multiple reports Wednesday revealed that Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith obtained a secret search warrant last January for information from former U.S. President Donald Trump's Twitter account. Trump spent most of his term in the White House posting thousands of Twitter comments. It's unclear exactly what information Smith was seeking with the search warrant. And while many American states permit cameras to televise courtroom proceedings, federal courts do not. Some U.S. lawmakers are trying to change that rule for the expected federal trials of Donald Trump. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
A televised trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump would likely draw massive interest. But since cameras are forbidden in federal courtrooms, only a few sketches now tell the story of his recent appearances in Washington and Miami. Changing the rules against televising proceedings would be a complex process.
The president's actions.
But several Democratic lawmakers and even Trump's lawyer, John Lauro, argue that cameras in court will improve transparency. In contrast, some, including the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, worry the presence of cameras could negatively impact trial proceedings. Former federal prosecutor Mark McDougall agrees.
I think it's really a question of the effect it has on the participants in the trial, the judges, the judge, the lawyers, the witnesses, and so forth.
Others argue that in America's highly polarized politics, where even basic facts are up for debate, camera feed could be critical for accountability, says political analyst Colvin Dark.
If there are no cameras in the courtroom, what the judges are then contributing to is the possibility of misinformation or somebody who's in the courtroom misrepresenting or taking out of context what actually happened.
Trump will be a presidential candidate when he goes on trial. Political scientist Dean Lacey says it's hard to predict how the televised proceedings will affect his popularity.
He could rally his supporters and get a lot of free airtime in the middle of a primary. It could also be a big negative. He could end up incriminating himself. He could end up losing a reputation among independents, maybe among some of his core supporters.
Nearly all U.S. states allow cameras in their courtrooms. High-profile cases, such as the trial of O.J. Simpson on murder charges or the murder conviction of Officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd, were broadcast live. A new indictment of Donald Trump on election-related charges is expected later this week in Georgia, where cameras are permitted in courtrooms at the judge's discretion. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. An armed Utah man accused of making violent threats against President Joe Biden was shot and killed by FBI agents hours before the president landed in the state Wednesday. The shooting happened as special agents tried to serve a warrant at the man's home. Kidnappers in Haiti released an American nurse and her daughter Wednesday, nearly 2 weeks after they were kidnapped at gunpoint from the campus of a Christian-run school near the capital city of Port-au-Prince, which is largely controlled by gangs. And in a sign of growing strains between the world's two biggest powers, President Joe Biden signed an executive order Wednesday that would block and regulate high-tech U.S.-based investments, including advanced computer chips exported to China. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have been finding evidence that elements of the universe are actually connected by filaments made mostly of dark matter and gas. Since this proposed structure of a connected universe resembles a giant spider web, it has become known as the cosmic web. A team of scientists recently used the James Webb Space Telescope to detect a string of the cosmic web from only 830 million years after the Big Bang, some 13 billion years ago. The Space Telescope Science Institute says scientists found a narrow filament that connects 10 galaxies, stretches out to a length of about 3 million light years, and is attached to a bright quasar in an ancient galaxy with an active supermassive black hole at its center. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Two Nigerian envoys traveled to the Niger capital for talks Wednesday as a former rebel leader and politician in Niger has launched a movement opposing the military junta that seized power 2 weeks ago, the first sign of organized resistance to army rule in the West African country. It's been 3 days since coup leaders in Niger ignored a deadline by the West African regional bloc ECOWAS to return Niger to civilian rule or face serious repercussions, including the possible use of force. In an interview with the Associated Press, strategic risk analyst Benedict Manzin said there could well be wider complications if a regional military push were to take place.
If it was to launch an intervention, it would still be in a position to overpower whatever Niger has, because the Nigerian military is so much larger than the Nigerian military.
Meanwhile, State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said Wednesday that the United States is concerned about the safety of ousted President Mohamed Bazoum.
We are greatly worried about his health and his personal safety and the personal safety of his family. In all of the conversations Secretary Blinken has had with President Bazoum, inquiring about his safety has been the first things he has brought up. It is one of the reasons that Acting Deputy Secretary Newland wanted to see him personally when she was in the country on Monday, and it's a matter that remains of concern to us.
Miller told reporters that Washington has no reason to dispute reports on the conditions Bazoum is being held under, which the party said included no running water, no electricity, and no access to fresh foods or doctors. The Nigerian Party for Democracy and Socialism, in a statement, called for a nationwide mobilization to save them. Hundreds of opponents of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko marched through the Polish capital of Warsaw Wednesday to mark the third anniversary of their unsuccessful attempt to unseat him in an election they say was rigged. 3 years into their exile, the Belarusian opposition is divided on the best way to reach power. A small but growing number of activists, though, believe now is the time to train for a real fight, while others are considering an organized political movement. Fiona Jones with Reuters has the story.
33-year-old Pavel Marjewski was an activist committed to peaceful politics. He'd never even held a weapon. 3 years ago, he fled his native Belarus after President Alexander Lukashenko's crackdown on protests following an election, that supporters of opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya believe she won. Last year, when Russia invaded Ukraine, Marjewski felt the call to battle and joined a Belarus volunteer unit fighting in support of Ukraine at the front.
At first, I thought about Ukraine, about Ukrainians, and about protecting life. Then I thought about Belarus, because I understood that if Russia loses the war, internal processes in the country will begin, which could be called a struggle for power or a struggle for survival. If the Russian elites begin fighting among themselves, who will take power after losing the war?
If Russia loses, this could mark a significant change in Belarus, and Marjewski, along with his fellow veterans of the Ukraine conflict, are bound to play a role in the fight for their own country.
I see this as an opportunity for us Belarusians to return home. Plus, the fact that we are in Ukraine gaining experience, this will most likely be useful to us in Belarus, because 2020 showed that protesting with flowers and white socks left on the benches gives you nothing.
A small but growing number of activists are saying now is the time to train for a real fight. But it's not just the physical fight, but political, that the opposition are prepared to undertake. 3 years on from the election her followers believe she won, Tikhanovskaya has all the trappings of a leader in waiting. She has a cabinet in exile, diplomatic missions, and regular meetings with Western dignitaries. Her status is no small feat, considering Belarus' opposition likely comprises a few thousand out of the 100,000 estimated to have left the country. Many face lengthy sentences for criminal charges in absentia should they return to Belarus. While they are divided over tactics and their politics range from liberalism to nationalism, they are united by their desire to end Lukashenko's near three-decade rule. They feel deep anger at his jailing and torturing of thousands of opponents and his close alliance with Russia, which they say negates Belarus's sovereignty. Opposition activists continue to build a covert network. They maintain over 20 alternative embassies and consulates for Belarusians abroad. They run at least two intelligence bodies, help Belarusians escape the country, and hackers are developing apps that allow safe communication within Belarus. However, most see a quick victory over Lukashenko as highly unlikely.
Fiona Jones reporting for Reuters. Geopolitical events such as war or the dissolution of a government like the collapse of the Soviet Union can leave people without a country. In the U.S., more than 200,000 people are living in a stateless status. VOA immigration reporter Eleni Barros has more.
Karina Bartzman-Clow is a stateless person living in the United States.
I was born in a country that doesn't exist anymore.
She's one of about 218,000 people in the United States who do not hold citizenship anywhere. Now, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, says it's setting up new procedures to clarify what stateless means for immigration purposes.
They've taken a huge step forward, and in terms of recognizing people like us in this country.
And Bartzman-Clow was born in Odessa, Ukraine, in 1988.
My parents had me as a mixed ethnic child. I'm half Armenian and half Ukrainian. And that was a problem. My dad was targeted for his ethnicity in Odessa, Ukraine. My mom suffered a miscarriage in my dad's city because she was beaten up in the streets.
Her family fled to Canada, then moved to the U.S. in 1996, where their asylum was denied. But by then, the Soviet Union had collapsed in 1991, and Ukraine had become an independent country.
We went to the Ukrainian embassy to get our passports and travel documents, or, you know, to return, and that's when they said, well, we don't recognize you as one of our own.
Stateless people in the U.S. don't have legal documents or identification to show who they are or where they come from, although some, like Karina and Barsman Glau, may have an invalid birth certificate.
The only thing I had to prove who I am was a birth certificate from a country that doesn't exist anymore. My Soviet birth certificate with a copy a notarized translation, that's all I had.
Others have nothing, and because of it, they have difficulty getting a job or even a place to live. This is immigration lawyer Margaret Stock.
So they're left in limbo, but physically inside the United States. And it makes no sense for us not to have a solution for this.
The DHS announcement promises to outline examples of information and evidence that can be used by citizenship and immigration officers to help stateless people get documentation, like a U.S. green card. Immigration lawyer Margaret Stock again.
So you run into a big problem many times with stateless people where they just simply can't prove that they're eligible for a green card because they can't get the documents from their home country.
But stateless people also can't be deported because they don't have a country to return to. And there's no international law requiring people to have citizenship in any particular country. Some countries let you have citizenship if you're born there. Other countries simply don't. Immigration lawyer Margaret Stock again.
The bottom line is it's very, very easy for people to end up without a country.
It's unclear if the new U.S. policy will allow some stateless people to get government-issued IDs or authorization to work legally in this country. And Bartman Klaus says she hopes the DHS guidance will finally help people in limbo like her. Aline Barros, VOA News, Washington.
A Brazil-hosted Amazon summit to protect the world's rainforests closed Wednesday. Leaders and ministers from 8 Amazon nations laid out plans to drive economic development in their countries while preventing the Amazon's ongoing demise from reaching a point of no return. I spoke with James Deutsch, CEO of the Rainforest Trust, to learn if the summit produced any concrete plans.
The first thing to note is that in the 6 months since President Lula has been back in office, it's since January, he and his team have already succeeded in cutting the deforestation rate in the Brazilian Amazon by approximately 44%. So really incredible. I don't think anyone thought that that would be possible in such a short period of time. So that's very, very worth saying. In terms of this meeting, many of us hoped that the 8 leaders could unanimously agree on zero deforestation across the Amazon by 2030, which is a commitment that Lula and Brazil have already made. That was a bridge a little bit too far for now, although hopefully the other countries will get there. But beyond that, I think Lula and Brazil had 2 reasons to call this meeting. One was to coordinate law enforcement because deforestation is driven mainly by land grabbing, and that crosses boundaries. And in addition, illegal gold mining also is causing tremendous pollution and humanitarian problems, and that requires transboundary law enforcement. So I think that's one reason why they called the meeting. The other is that Lula has a vision that if he can get all the Amazon countries to speak as one and then join together with the countries of the Congo Basin in Africa and with the rainforests of Southeast Asia, then together that one voice for the world's tropical rainforests can actually force the rest of the world to come to the table and provide the support that's necessary.
And there's cattle ranching too, correct?
Yes. Within Brazil in particular, conversion of the forest, burning down and cutting down the forest to create cattle ranching is by far the largest source of deforestation, by far the biggest threat to the Amazon. Much of that is illegal or quasi-legal, and it accelerated drastically under Lula's predecessor, Bolsonaro, during his 4 years in office, because Bolsonaro said, come and do it. He said, we're not going to enforce the laws against people just coming in and seizing the land and chopping down the forest and turning it into cattle pasture. So Lula came in 6 months ago and said, that's the end of that. We're now going to enforce our laws properly. And that's already having a hugely positive impact.
Fantastic. This issue in general is not new. This has been There's been concern about the destruction and deforestation of the Amazon rainforests for decades. It's obviously been getting to very critical stages. Why do you think that it has taken this long to really see concrete action being taken to address this?
Well, in Brazil in particular, there was tremendous progress on this issue in the early noughts. In particular, during Lula's previous 8 years in office from 2003 to 2011. Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon was cut by 80% during that time, in part by ensuring that global beef markets only accepted Brazilian beef that was proved to come from legitimate pastures instead of newly deforested ones. So there was progress, but then Brazil has slipped back. And deforestation has crept back up, although not as high as it was before. So in a sense, Brazil knows how to solve this problem, and it just has needed the political will to get back to solving it. Now we'd like to see that political will right across the Amazon basin.
We were last year really watching with horror as these fires were out of control, and the term the lungs of the earth came up. The Amazon really is considered the lungs of the earth. Explain why the Amazon truly is so critical to life on Earth.
So the Amazon is the largest tropical rainforest on Earth by far. It's much bigger than the Congo Basin or the rainforests of Southeast Asia. And it's the third largest forest of any kind, the other being the boreal forests of Russia and Canada. And it's critical in three ways. First of all, it recycles a huge amount of rain. So the rain that falls in the Amazon falls down, goes into the trees evaporate it back into the air, and it falls again. And so it creates its own weather. And that creates the weather across all of South America. So as the Amazon is being killed and 17% is already gone, there is a huge risk, and we're already beginning to see it happen, that that rainfall recycling stops and the whole climate of South America changes, which threatens agriculture and everything. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the Amazon, as the world's largest rainforest, holds a vast amount of carbon. And if you dump all that carbon into the air, then this will have just a massive, massive, massive impact accelerating climate change. And the third thing is that a healthy forest actually sucks carbon out of the air and puts it into wood and then into soil. And we desperately need that mechanism to pull out of the air the carbon that you and I are putting in. So for all those reasons, the Amazon is absolutely critical to the climate and really to all of us.
James Deutsch, CEO of the Rainforest Trust. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fierce gang violence continues to plague the people of Haiti. Many of the attacks are very brutal in nature, explained Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Caribbean Affairs and Haiti, Barbara Feinstein, in a recent briefing.
These include indiscriminate attacks on women and children, including sexual and gender-based violence, widespread kidnappings, extortion, and other means of harassment, which threaten food security, the delivery of humanitarian assistance, and basic livelihoods.
The United States continues to pursue a comprehensive approach in Haiti, including assistance to strengthen, train, and equip the Haitian National Police. Towards this end, Secretary of State Antony Blinken commended the government of Haiti for considering to serve as the lead nation for a multinational force in Haiti to help take on the scourge of gang violence. The United States supports the Haitian National Police as leading any efforts to improve security in Haiti, including through a multinational force, stressed Deputy Assistant Secretary Feinstein.
Our assistance to the Haitian National Police, more than $120 million in the last 2 years, has increased the HNP's institutional capacity to stem gang violence in Greater Port-au-Prince, including by equipping vetted specialized officers to undertake complex anti-gang operations, to work with community policing units in vulnerable neighborhoods and to provide experts to advise HNP leadership.
The next steps for the Kenyan government are to perform an assessment on the ground in Haiti. And provided the Kenyans are able to secure approval from their own government to lead a multinational force, they would then work with the United Nations to gain UN authorization of such a force, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Feinstein.
The United States is prepared to introduce a resolution authorizing an MNF, and we look forward to working with our partners on the Security Council to secure its swift passage.
The United States is encouraged by this development to improve Haiti's security through a multinational force. As Secretary Blinken affirmed, our support for the people of Haiti remains unwavering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.